climb this tree. Yes, see as they climb ever higher, foot over foot, branch over branch, until, oh no, a branch is broken and the Datanauts fall and fall until rescued by it. Is that a bit of fabric? Why, yes, as the Datanauts land on the fabric, the tree fades away and the fabric becomes all that is needed to get around. Today, the Datanauts explore the data center fabric, finding out what this whole leaf spine thing is all about. What is a leaf spine network? How does it work? And why is it a good fit for modern data centers? I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. This is the Datanauts podcast, which you can find at packetpushers.net. Joining me today is Chris Wall and Drew Conroy Murray. Mr. Drew, would you say hi to the Packet Pushers audience?
Hi, it's Drew Conroy Murray. You can find me on Twitter at Drew_CM, and you may have heard me on the network break, but I'm excited to be hanging out in space with the Datanauts.
Woohoo! And Chris, how you doing, my friend? You're on the road this week.
Oh, yeah. I'm in the land of delicious steak up in Chicago because I like steak.
You have to describe this steak that you had last night because you really went on about it, and I was rather impressed, I got to say.
You know what? No, I'm a little hurt. I'm a little wounded in the heart about your insulting my A5 rated Wagyu steak, so I'm not going to talk about it and its delicious marbling anymore.
What bothers me is the fact not only that a steak is rated, but that you also knew it. That's just like Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake kind of stuff.
Hey, you know what? Go big or go home. And the sun's out, so guns are out. So let's do it.
So the show today, as you guys that listen to Datanauts know, Chris and I like to engage in what we call silo busting, where if you're used to being very specialized in one area of the data center, we think that's nonsense because the best way to build a data center is to know what's going on in other parts of the data center, and everyone should be sharing the knowledge about their technical areas of expertise, working together, and then building a solution that is awesome for delivering applications. That's what it's all about. And so he and I keep going back and forth on things that we have done some homework on, know a little bit about, maybe have done some projects with in real life. One of the topics that came up was leaf spine network. What the heck is a leaf spine network and so on? If you're someone who doesn't build networks, you could give a crap. It is,
wow.
It's, to you, it's just the port you plug into, and you don't care if it's leaf spine, tree network, spanning tree, something you heard about that you probably think is bad. And so, but I don't really care what the network is. Just as long as it works, man, just deliver my stuff and leave me alone. But I think there's more to the network foundation that is in our data centers than just, it's the port I plug into and I don't want to know anything more. If we all know a bit more about the network foundation, we kind of have some clue as to how our applications ought to behave when running across that network. And the network's the thing, the glue, if you will, that holds all of our apps together. Wouldn't you agree, Mr. Wall?
Yeah, I'm thinking back to a time when I was working in the data center. I was working for a large enterprise. And I was a little shaky on the architecture of the network. We're going to cover the various tiers and such. But what the various tiers were, where I'd want to plug into. And it actually caused contention because I didn't realize I was plugged into a tier that I'm not normally plugged into. And it caused contention with trying to plumb my NFS network into the storage. So understanding for me as a server/virtualization engineer, where I was at in the network, what I was plugged into, and how I get from my server to storage, whatever I'm trying to get to, was actually important. This is where I feel like we're scratching the question that says, you know, why do I care? Because it does matter, and it affects your design as a server or virtualization guy or gal doing engineering.
Yeah, there are elements that are maybe nice to know, and there's some that, as you say, Chris, I think are better if it's, I think of it more as a need to know. Leaf spine as a specific kind of network architecture comes up in this conversation because it is the reference network architecture that we're seeing come from network vendors these days. If you ask a network vendor, hey, show me your latest data center network design, they're very likely going to show you leaf spine. So the big idea of the show today is just to walk us through what that specific network design is all about, the benefits of it, and then walk away with some ideas about why that's good for our apps.
Let's get started. Ethan, I think the first thing that folks in the server and virtualization world would like to know is, I alluded to various tiers of architecture. What are the network architecture tiers that you're used to, or I guess are kind of common today, that would define, you know, existing architecture?
Right. The normal data center architecture, which really hasn't changed a lot over, almost 20 years, I would say, would be the what they call the traditional three-tier architecture. There's three layers, a core layer, an aggregation layer, and an access layer. And let's define each of those. and I'm going to define these in my own vernacular way. I'm not going with textbook definitions here. I'm going with, in the real world, when you build this stuff, this is what these tiers tend to be used for. So the core layer would be where the routing happens between disparate segments, maybe between your data center and the WAN, or between your data center and the internet, possibly between different sections within your data center if you've got different BUs that are separated in a particular way. There's a lot of routing that happens down there in the core. Then we have a kind of a middle tier, which would be the aggregation layer. Some people term that the distribution layer. And this would be where all your access layer switches interconnect, this middle aggregation layer tier. And the idea is, if traffic can be switched through the aggregation layer, don't push it down into the core layer. Keep your core layer as clear as possible, as clean as possible, and push traffic through your aggregation layer between access switches when you can. The access layer then is where you have network access. If you're a server administrator and you're trying to plug into the network, you're plugging in at the access layer. If we were talking in an enterprise campus context, the access layer would be like your closet switch where you're plugging in people's desktops and wireless access points and so on.
Based on some of my experience and the descriptions you made, most of my ESXi servers we plugged into access. Although I did have a couple scenarios where, because I guess it was a smaller data center or not, there was not necessarily all the tiers that you talked about.
That's exactly right. So the core aggregation and access model that is traditional is where you would find networks of size, that you've got a lot of ports out there, and it kind of looks like a tree. You've got a lot of switches at the access layer, a smaller number of switches at an aggregation layer than a very few number of switches at the core layer. If you don't need all of that port density, you maybe don't need all of those layers. And so you could have a collapsed core. Something would be as small as switches that do everything. They're the access switch and they're also the core, all in one. I've seen this in very small data centers where maybe you've got two Cisco Catalyst 6513s used to be a big switch back in the day, and everyone just plugged everything in the whole data center into these two great big switches. So you do see that in some smaller environments. These days, maybe that's a Nexus 7K or 7700 or a Nexus 9000. And that model works as well. If that's all you need for scale, then that is certainly viable.
So this core, this three-tier architecture that sort of evolved, was this because of constraints of protocols and because of the actual capabilities, the throughput of the switches themselves? Like, how did we come to this decision that we're going to go build three tiers?
Few things. One would be exactly that, Drew, scale, where I've got a lot of racks out there in the data center. And so I'm going to use a top of rack switch to connect them. If I've got a lot of racks, I've got to plumb these back to something. And you just exceed your ability to plug everything into a couple of great big chassis switches. They don't make chassis switches that big in the world to handle that. And so you need a construct where you can scale out those switches and then interconnect them one to another. The middle layer there and this ultimate tree design is also useful for things like security boundaries. I want to put a checkpoint in where I'm inspecting traffic. By checkpoint, I don't mean the brand of firewall, although it certainly could be. I mean, you need to check traffic at some particular point, and so you build out switches such that traffic has to traverse from one physical switch to another, and now you can intercept it and inspect it at a predictable point. Be another design that's come up over the years.
It almost sounds like trial and error, and based on scale, is we went away from mainframe, we got to the LAN model, the server client model. It just kind of became a necessity to have a lot more ports. You know, you couldn't use hubs anymore. You had to start switching, and then various security points. Sounded like it was just almost a crafting of an architecture that got refined year after year until we finally said, yeah, this one works. It may not be the best thing since sliced bread, but it takes care of business.
It is proven to be scalable. If you know how to do routing between the layers and so on, you know how to get the results out of it you want in a predictable way and in a way that can be controlled. And so while not every network that uses three layers looks exactly the same, there's a lot of network design references that refer to this model. So people will build something that looks like that and then riff on it a little bit for their own specific needs.
So the burning question on my mind, you know, I'm the server guy, where's my VLANs? Where do they live? And can I spread them everywhere?
So your VLANs are living in the access switches and in the aggregation layer switches as well. If you don't have an aggregation layer, then it could be access in your core layer as well too. And in smaller shops, that's typically what I see. And yeah, you can put your layer 2 everywhere in that model.
Woo-hoo.
So, right. Right. And then the challenge becomes, and again, we haven't even gotten to leaf spine yet. We're still talking about a traditional network model. Your challenge then becomes spanning tree in legacy network architectures. Every VLAN, for the most part, every VLAN has got its own spanning tree instance. And spanning tree is all about making sure there are no loops in the network, and that is managed on a per VLAN instance. It becomes challenging for a network designer with a whole bunch of VLANs out there to keep all of that straight.
And normally when I hear spanning tree, especially from when I'm talking to network folks, it's like in the Star Trek episode, Wrath of Khan, the movie where Kirk's going, Khan! It's like spanning tree. I mean, why does everyone seem to hate it so much? What did it do to network engineers and architects in the past that just causes so much angst?
Spanning tree has certain default behaviors, which if you leave spanning tree to its defaults, you end up with a suboptimal design. So I think it helps to take a step back and understand what spanning tree is all about. At its root, it is all about loop prevention. That is what spanning tree does. Ethernet, which is what we're all used to as far as our networks and our data centers, Ethernet has no time to live. It has no loop prevention built into it. If you send a frame on an Ethernet wire and it's not delivered to its destination, it can just go around and around the network forever until it hits a dead end. So if you've got a loop, Ethernet frames will literally live forever. Spanning tree is the mechanism that makes sure there are no loops on the network so that that can't happen. Spanning tree gets blamed for a lot of things it's not actually responsible for a lot of times. Like you're making the joke about God, spanning tree, why? This goes back to what I was saying. Spanning tree has defaults, and if you leave spanning tree to its defaults, you end up with it blocking links maybe in a suboptimal way. So the traffic's flowing around the network kind of oddly. You turn up new links and just kind of let spanning tree recalculate as it sees the new links and do its thing. If you aren't in control of that spanning tree, if you don't know exactly what's going to happen when you plug in a new link, you can cause a spanning tree convergence event that causes spanning tree to block all links until he's got a chance to rediscover everything and then decide who should be forwarding and who should be blocking. All of these things are preventable. There are modern versions of spanning tree, rapid spanning tree, multiple spanning tree, all have timers that can be tuned and are very fast. And if you are conscientiously designing your spanning tree as a network designer, where you know who the root of the spanning tree is because you've set it as such, you take a lot of the seeming unpredictability out of the equation because you're controlling. It's always predictable. It's just a math problem. But again, if you don't actually know how your spanning tree is set up and how it's working, it can cause that feeling of anxiety. I'm about to turn up a new switch. I'm about to plug in a new line, and I don't know what's going to happen next because spanning tree is this thing you don't know, when in fact it can be carefully managed and controlled. That said, spanning tree kind of sucks in a lot of ways. It is relatively easy to break the topology. There isn't really any security by default in it, and so on. It can be frustrating in that sense. You really have to be vigilant to control and manage your spanning tree to prevent any switches from showing up and participating in spanning tree that you didn't mean to and influencing decisions in a bad way, like the guy that comes in with his Best Buy switch at his desktop and plugs in, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, what did the lights just go dim? What happened?
And it looks like a casino slot machine going off on the switchport lights. So
exactly right.
I'm hoping that it does leaf spine. I mean, we should talk about that. We should go into leaf spine. And I'm like, on my footnote, my personal burning in my heart is that spanning tree is not an issue with leaf spine. I don't know. Level set on what this is.
Let me articulate one of the big problems with spanning tree, maybe the biggest problem for data center and for scaling, which is since spanning tree has a job to prevent loops, it does that by blocking links. So one link is forwarding, everybody else is blocking, and that's it. Those are the rules. What kind of blows to do that if you've got, let's say, a 10 gig switch with some 40 gig uplinks? You want to use all those 40 gig uplinks. You don't want to have one active and one be standby because, holy crap, a 40 gig port's expensive. You want to be forwarding on all those links.
Wait, so you mean it's blocking just even when things are healthy and normal, it's still blocking in that event?
That's right.
It's not just when there's an issue?
That's exactly right. So that when you're looking at a spanning tree topology, you would see that there's no loops. Well, why is there no loop? Because one of the links has been put in a blocked state by spanning tree to remove the loop from the network. So right, if you have two switches with two links in between each of them, one of those links is not forwarding traffic. He's just sitting there idle, waiting to take over in case the primary link goes down for some reason.
That sounds expensive.
Well, yeah. And then in a modern data center design, that is.
What's your 40 gig port doing? Nothing. Just sitting there. It's enjoying a cup of tea. You know,
well, one's working, but the rest are not. Yeah, no, no one wants to do that. So so leaf spine doesn't inherently, I mean, leaf spine is a physical topology design. It doesn't fix spanning tree, but what you layer on top of a leaf spine design does. So let's talk through this here. We talked about the three-tier architecture of a core aggregation and access layer. Leaf spine replaces that. What does it replace it with? It replaces it with a CLOS architecture, C-L-O-S, which is not an acronym. CLOS is actually someone's name, and I'll read an entry from Wikipedia here that describes what a CLOS network is. And Wikipedia says, in the field of telecommunications, a CLOS network is a kind of multi-stage circuit switching network first formalized by Charles CLOS in 1952, which represents a theoretical idealization of practical multi-stage telephone switching systems. CLOS networks Whoa. Are required when the physical circuit switching needs to exceed the capacity of the largest feasible single crossbar switch. So I'll just pause there. There's more I could read, but the big idea here is you need some way to connect a whole bunch of access switches to a whole bunch of other access switches. And the way we're going to do that is with a spine switch in the middle. So you could kind of think of the spine switch in the middle as the crossbar that's being discussed in this article here. And CLOS networks in networking show up all over the place. They're inside of switches as well, down at the chip level where you never even see them. And there's a lot of interesting math theory and queuing theory that goes into what happens inside of a CLOS network that allow you to connect a whole bunch of ports to a whole bunch of other ports without being able to directly connect every one to every other one. You got that crossbar in the middle that makes that happen.
I would say I've heard of that technology or that name used, crossbar and the fabric pieces of a switch. So it sounds like almost taking the concept that's used in a switch and disaggregating it, kind of making it a little more modular and building a network around it.
Yeah. And in fact, some vendors who really like leaf spine topology will describe it as, well, yeah, it's like one gigantic switch in a way, and the remote switches, the top of rack switches, are kind of like a line card in a chassis. I've heard them make that analogy, which kind of speaks to what you're saying there. It's sort of a disaggregated switch. Yeah.
Got it. And what's the difference between the leaf and the spine, or did you have more on the definition to go over?
So no, this is actually a good place for us to go next. If we assume that leaf spine is a type of CLOS network, and those of you that are interested in the theory and want to know more about that, it's a Google search away to stick around for CLOS networks, and there's tons of great articles as deep and heavy as you want to go. The leaf would be the access layer. We were talking about the access layer before in the traditional three-tier architecture.
So that's where I'm plugging in, is the leaf.
So that's where you're plugging in. That's right. That's your top of rack switch. That's your leaf layer. And then the spine layer would be, you could consider it the core layer, although it isn't exactly true, because in a leaf spine architecture, when we get into the software that's layered on top of this physical design, the spines, for the most part, don't actually do all that much. They're just like fast ways to get between the leaf layers. So it's kind of different, whereas in a traditional network, a core is the device that knows how to get to all of your other network segments. The spine, that may not actually be the case. So I'm kind of calling it the core layer, but it really isn't. It's not a great analogy, but it's the best way I could.
It's almost like the highway, and I'm using a leaf as my on-ramp just to get somewhere else.
Yeah, the spines in a lot of cases in these modern DC architectures, they're just big, fast, and dumb.
That's how I like my switches.
That's right. So the spine is very often simple as possible, and just it's more about port density and less about magical capabilities that the spine can do. So if we were to take a really simple leaf spine architecture, you could have two leaves and two spines, and that's it. Doesn't have to be more complicated than that. Or if you need to go a little bit bigger, you know, four leaf switches connecting into two spine switches. I'm going to talk a little bit more later on into how all these are connected and some of the interesting bits about it. But let's kind of round off what leaf spine is actually all about and talk about interconnections for a second here.
Yeah, I'd like to understand how they're all plugging into each other, because it sounds like, all right, I got two leaves, two spines. I'm not 100% on the level. Preach it, brother. Tell me how it works.
So the big magic here is that all leaf switches are connected to all spine switches. So let's do something that's a little more realistic. I got four leaves and two spine switches. All four leaf switches are plugged into both spine switches. So if you look at every top of rack leaf switch, he's got a home run into both spine switches, you know, all the way across. All of those links are forwarding. once you've applied the right software to this mix, we'll talk about how that is. We've taken Spanning Tree out of the mix here. And again, it's not that the physical connectivity of leaf spine means we can just do away with Spanning Tree, but in a modern design that's using leaf spine, you've also got some other software that is handling this for us. We'll talk about that in just a second. But there's one other point I want to make about the interconnections. Leaf switches don't connect to each other. Spine switches don't connect to each other. I've seen some exception cases where you might have a reason to do that, but for the most part, you never see that in production. Leaves always connect to spines. Leaves don't connect to each other. Spines don't connect to each other. And that is all about having a very predictable data path and not burning ports needlessly. You want traffic to go from leaf to spine and then back to leaf again. There's no reason spines would need to forward between one another because there's nothing there for them to connect to. They're going to be connecting from a resource on a leaf to a resource that's on another leaf. Why would a spine connect to each other? You'd just be burning a port in that scenario. And the same thing with leaves, with some rare exceptions that we don't need to go into here.
So I'm curious about what prompted the switch from the traditional three-tier now to the leaf spine. Was it customer frustration about not having access to all the ports they're buying? Was it the rise of virtualization and applications and virtual machines running around the network and needing a better way to handle that? Why do we get this change in architecture?
Yeah, the big thing I would say is east-west traffic. High-performance computing has also had a bearing on this. Distributed computing, where you're pushing a lot of data between nodes within the data center. It was looking for an architecture that would scale, that would give predictable data forwarding characteristics to those sorts of problems where there are two nodes within the data center, but you don't know where they are in the data center. They could be anywhere, needing to be able to communicate with one another in a predictable way. And by predictable, I mean a predictable latency characteristic. You know how long in microseconds it's going to take for the packet to go into the fabric and come out of the fabric on the other side, because that's important to certain computing problems. It is also helpful for scaling. If you're looking for a network architecture that can scale in a predictable way, leaf spine is a very good way to do that. Whereas the three-tier model is, you can do it. I mean, you can make the three-tier model look like leaf spine and then scale it in a similar way. But you definitely want to be getting rid of spanning tree in that case, because you need to have all those links forwarding to get the scale as well. So those are the big drivers we're seeing with that.
I'm glad you brought that up, Ethan, because I'm thinking, all right, spanning tree is already disabled for me anyways, because we typically disable it on the ports facing an ESXi host. But you're saying that's not even coming into the equation here. It's more about, I have all these expensive 1040 gig links. I want to use all of them and not have to do some kind of blocked spanning tree port because of the loop prevention. It's helping me understand a little more of the architecture.
Yeah, exactly. And so networking has come up with several different kinds of fabrics that you would deploy over a physical leaf spine architecture to assist with this. Early on, we were just talking about the three-tier architecture. I was mentioning spanning tree. You were asking, oh, can my VLANs go everywhere? You know, and then this kind of stuff. And for those sorts of data centers, typically smaller ones that still want to do basically that, only use all their links and be forwarding, you've got layer two multipathing technologies that take the place of spanning tree. Big ones would include shortest path bridging, trill, and variants of trill like fabric path, which will, again, allow VLANs everywhere and still prevent loops, while at the same time allowing all links to be in a forwarding state. You see some implementations of that that's out there. I think Cisco sold a good bit of fabric path in their world. I don't think anything is probably as widely deployed as fabric path. Avaya has had a lot of success with shorter path bridging in some data center applications. Although SPB is an interesting technology for service providers as well, who are trying to do some very different things with it. SPB is one of those interesting protocols that does lots of nifty stuff, but I digress. So layer two multipath is one of the replacements for spanning tree that you might see deployed in leaf spine. Another would be just a straight layer three network. And what we mean by that is we're not running VLANs and extending them all over the place within the data center. Instead, we're running straight layer three links and relying on IP transport. We're not expecting an Ethernet frame to make it from one part of the data center to another necessarily. In this scenario, you're very scalable. You know, there's no loops because it's layer three, not layer two. So we're relying on IP and routing as opposed to Ethernet. and we're isolating layer two networks to specific parts of the data center in that scenario, which there's a lot of data centers that were designed that way. This network lives in this pod, and that's it. It never gets outside of this switch, and it's layer three in between to connect. That works wonderfully well. You don't even have to have leaf spine to do that. It just happens to be a way that we know how to scale data centers very large with layer three. Although we still might have a need to want to extend layer two all over the data center, but we've kind of outgrown a layer two multipathing technology. And so now we see layer three with overlays like VXLAN, where it's a layer three design underneath, but then over the top, we've got some tunneling protocol like VXLAN that encapsulates an Ethernet frame and can ship it anywhere in the data center that it needs to go. But the leaf spine switches don't care about what's inside the VXLAN packet. All they care about is moving VXLAN packets around between VXLAN tunnel endpoints. What do you think about that, Mr. Wall?
Sounds like some NSX magic to me. I'm in. I'm digging it.
So I say all of that to really raise a point that the vast majority of listeners probably aren't running a layer three network and probably are a pure layer three network and probably aren't running a layer three with overlay network either, because those are for huge scale where you've got thousands upon thousands of endpoints out there. But we hear it talked about so much. I think a lot of people go, oh my gosh, that's what I need. We have to run a pure layer three network. I got to be running VXLAN or probably not. You only have a few thousand hosts, you know, a few thousand routes. Anything can handle that, man. Anything can handle that. You don't have to go crazy.
Just a few thousand hosts. No big deal. I would imagine that's not a huge chunk of folks. I think once you hit 1,000, you start hitting unique challenges that, you know, when you're in the 400 to 500 range, you're not encountering. But I think my last thought on the fabrics you're talking about is I hope we're still not in a world where we're trying to get VLANs everywhere. I know there's some applications that just require discovering one another over Mac or something goofy like that. But if you look at what VMware's done as an example over the past couple revisions, they'll allow you to route just about everything now, from vMotion to storage traffic to management, etc. They have different TCP/IP stacks built within the kernel. That there's really a lot of those caveats from a hypervisor perspective have been removed. I think we're left with physical and some virtual applications that may require that. But the rest of what you're talking about, building a very simple fabric, sounds like a great way forward. I'm excited about talking about this more with you.
It's clear that some new requirements came along that just made the three-tier architecture untenable, and those things are the rise of virtualization, more east-west traffic, virtual machines running around the network, and they really drove this new architecture. But before you get that new architecture, you also needed new protocols like Trill and Fabric Path to actually make it possible so you could move away from spanning tree.
You know, I looked up Trill, transparent interconnection of lots of links.
Yep.
It's such a goofy acronym, like lots of links. How many lots? There are many of them.
And I believe for some trivia there, the person who created spanning tree, Radia Perlman, also created Trill. So she undid her own work.
Right on. Most people just come with a problem. Not many people come with a solution. So I dig that. So as I'm hearing leaf spine, what I'm thinking is, wow, it's a lot of ports, a lot of connections being consumed. Hopefully we have distances that allow for TwinAx, just because I know how extensive those LC-LC cables are, although the SFPs are really where the money's made. So a lot more connections, but I also like the idea of plugging in my virtual machines and my hosts and knowing that everything in the network is going to go leaf to a spine to a leaf, and it's there potentially. You know, that's kind of the hope, rather than, okay, I'm coming from this access side to this aggregation or distribution area up to a core off to somewhere else. Who knows where it's going? It's all kind of this crusty architecture that's been built forever. So it feels like a little bit of a cleaner architecture, which may make my life easier because I don't have to pull out the eye chart of architecture for the network to figure out how I'm getting from A to B.
Just give me my VLAN. Before we go on with the podcast, I want to say thanks to today's sponsor, Athena Health. Athena Health aims to be the most trusted service for healthcare providers, and hey, they're hiring. Athena Health is hiring actively and aggressively, and they're looking for a wide range of technical skill sets across several U.S. locations, including Watertown, Massachusetts. Positions include Linux and Windows administration, network and telecom engineering, information security and incident response, database administration, web operations, and more. So if you're the type of candidate that isn't afraid to speak up and innovate when needed and likes solving complex problems with any technology, and you're interested in disrupting the healthcare space, Athena Health wants to talk to you. You can get more details on jobs and opportunities at www.athenahealth.com/careers. That's www.athenahealth.com/careers. Athena Health is connecting care nationwide with cloud-based services and mobile tools for medical groups and health systems. With a network of more than 59,000 providers, Athena Health is helping providers thrive through change and focus on patient care.
So I think we've done a pretty decent job. Ethan, I'll give you adequate marks. You're a B plus so far on the leaf spine architecture and level setting what all that does. But you keep talking about scale. You said this, 1,000 hosts, 1,000, whatever it may be on my network, that's easy stuff. So what kind of scale are we really looking to achieve with a leaf spine architecture?
So let me qualify hosts and versus virtual machines. If you've got 1,000 virtual machines, I should say, that's not big scale.
Aw, you hurt my feelings.
I know,
I felt
right?
so big.
Because it's pretty easy to stand up 1,000 virtual machines on modern x86 hardware, right? You get some CPUs in there, cram it full of memory. You can really build a lot of machines in not that many rack units.
Yeah, it's probably 20 or 30 servers, total of 60, 80, something like that, links from end to end. Not a big deal.
Exactly, right. So the question then is, how big does a leaf spine actually need to go for most environments? And I would say, for the most part, not very big. Ivan Pepelniak, who runs the blog at ipspace.net, has got a great article on this that's kind of fun to read. He shows you the math and demonstrates, if you're running X number of virtual machines, you can fit it into this many physical hosts. How many switches do you actually need to support that? And the answer is, you're going to run an awful lot of data centers on like 2 switches. You don't even need leaf spine.
It's like the sad trombone of architecture.
And the thing of it is, there's so much horsepower now in x86 crammed down into that small spot with a couple of 10 gig links coming out of it. You just plug that into a switch and you're done. Most modern data center switches are non-blocking, meaning that if you put an Ethernet frame into the front of the thing, it's going to come out on the other side, and it's not going to be impeded unless you're trying to send traffic from 2 inbound ports to the same outbound port. Obviously, both of those inbound packets are going to be contending for the same outbound side. But aside from that situation, a non-blocking switch means you can run all ports at full throttle, bidirectionally, and it's never going to drop any traffic.
How long have we been doing that, though? As I remember, spacing the ports that I plug into by each ASIC, or making sure that I don't oversubscribe a chunk of ports on my switch. When did we transition to the world of non-blocking?
Fairly recent, I would say, where you kind of expect it as a standard. The last 3-4 years, you start seeing that more and more, and now it's just an expectation. If you're buying a data center class switch, it's non-blocking. That is typical. But you're exactly right. You know, it used to be the strategy was a certain number of ports, maybe 6 or 8 front panel ports, were mapped into an ASIC inside the box. And that ASIC had a certain amount of bandwidth allocated to it, and it was oversubscribed to some degree. And so you were counting on the burstiness of typical data center traffic, meaning that that wouldn't be a big problem for you. Non-blocking is the assumption today.
So now we're bathing in port bandwidth. So I guess we can go pretty insanely huge with leaf spine then. If we're already living with buckets of bandwidth to spare, I guess you'd have to be enormous to require a leaf spine architecture then.
So, right. So step one is, if you've got non-blocking switches, you can get an awful long way with just a pair of switches for redundancy and some big iron plugged into them. But now if we need to go to leaf spine, what does that look like? And as soon as we do that, we've got a leaf layer and a spine layer. We do have an interconnection to consider between the leaf and the spine, where we're going to introduce some oversubscription. It is possible to build a total non-blocking fabric where your leaf and your spine interconnect is one-to-one. So the host coming into the access layer, and then the interconnectivity between leaf and spine, that access layer and the spine layer, is all one-to-one, and you're just non-blocking. But typically, you don't build that.
Yeah, that sounds like if I were to buy my cable internet subscription and everyone had the full 100 megabit or something,
you know, dedicated,
they would
that.
Go out of business.
Yeah, that's right.
It would not work.
No, there's an assumption of some shared resources there because, yeah, you can build it. You know, how much money you got? So more typically, the rule of thumb that I've heard is 3-to-1 oversubscription ratio. And let me describe that for you. Let's say you've got a leaf switch that's got 48 10 gig ports and 4 40 gig ports. So 48 10 gig ports is 480 gigabits per second of bandwidth that could be flowing into the switch from the hosts. And then you would use the 40 gig ports to connect down to your spine layer. 4 40 gig ports, that's 160 gig of bandwidth. So the ratio of 480 to 160 is 3-to-1. And that's a pretty decent rule of thumb that I've heard that works for a majority of data center scenarios. The assumption is not every host that's plugged into the access switch is going to be talking a full 10 gigabits a second all the time. That's not going to happen. traffic bursts, right? You've got a request here. This pops up on the wire. A backup's running over to this host. Not everybody's filling the pipe all the time. And so some oversubscription is perfectly normal. And again, that 3-to-1 is a pretty decent rule of thumb.
So this feels like a good silo busting part. I've been asked by network folks, hey, how much traffic are you going to send? What kind of traffic are you doing? The 3-to-1 being generic shouldn't be used as a rule, I'm assuming. We should start there and then slide the bar more towards 2-to-1 or 4-to-1 based on a conversation with the application owners, although they may not know that well, or at the very least the server and virtualization folks who can see what the hosts are pushing, right?
You're exactly right. You do need to know the data flowing around your data center, and oversubscription ratios can vary dramatically by environment. So if we shift out of the data center mindset for a moment and think about campus architectures, it's very common to have 100-to-1 or 200-to-1 oversubscription from office machines that are connecting into a closet switch and then plumbed into, you know, a core distribution layer. Why? They don't talk that much. It doesn't take much to use a website or to check email. In a data center, it's different, though, because if we're assuming IP storage particularly, there's no dedicated storage network. You're sharing your Ethernet and IP network for storage. You got a lot of storage traffic. You got a lot of database traffic that's going on, potentially, depending on your applications. You've got backup traffic and so on. Many different flows, elephant flows in a lot of cases, that can be eating up certain amounts of bandwidth. And so therefore, right, people need to know on the host side, whether that's server application folks, need to be able to say, my application is going to chew up X amount of bandwidth during the course of the day based on this monitoring that I've done. Scale that out across the data center and then figure out what is a safe oversubscription ratio. Network engineers love to overbuild stuff too. So when I say 3-to-1 is a ratio, that's a good rule of thumb. That's probably a very safe rule of thumb for the most part.
Good starting point, yeah. And you mentioned elephant flows. Maybe not everyone's familiar with that. Elephant and mice flows. Could you talk a little bit about what that is? Just define it.
Elephant flows are just very large and long-lived flows. A backup would be an example of that. You've got many gigabytes or possibly more of data you've got to move between these two endpoints, and it's going to be a very large, long-lived flow. It's going to be loud. It's going to take up a lot of pipe, because you've probably got big iron on either end of this thing, a host that can shove a lot of data down the line and a backup system that can accept that high bandwidth flow.
It's like a Hootie and the Blowfish concert. It's loud. It goes on forever. It's annoying.
And then mice flows. Mice flows are really small, quick bursts of traffic that can get stepped on by elephant flows if a line is taken up with that noisy elephant flow. Elephant versus mice flows are some interesting kind of sidebar issues there, but it's part of understanding how what those flows look like in your data center are part of how you design what your oversubscription ratio, among other things, are going to look like on the network.
So I have a question about another way to look at the architecture differences. What about latency as it pertains to going across a traditional three-tier architecture versus the leaf spine? It seems like there's less switches to go across, so latency might be improved. But then again, I'm reading stuff where it's like the latency on a port is 4 nanoseconds or something like that. Do we care?
You care depending on how latency sensitive your world is. Like the company Arista has in part made their name on having very low latency switches. That was one of their calling cards for back in the day. Yeah, we're faster than Cisco switches because our port-to-port latency is so low. And what we're talking about here is over the years, we've seen port-to-port latency, meaning traffic going into a port and then traffic leaving a port, and probably not including the PHY, the physical element that is used to translate your optical signal into a straight-up electrical signal that goes inside of the switch, leaving that element of it out. How long does it take that switch to push that little chunk of data through the physical switch? And we've gone from it's 2 microseconds, it's 1.5 microseconds, it's 1 microsecond. Now we're measuring in hundreds of nanoseconds where we're pushing that port-to-port latency down and down and down as ASICs and chips get faster and faster. For most enterprise users, you probably don't care because 1 microsecond in a transaction is not a particularly interesting statistic because the overall transaction is going to take so much longer inside of the application stack where you're doing a database query or waiting for some kind of a lookup or, whatever it is.
It's like the switch is adding 0.01% of the total time that it takes to do
something. Exactly right.
It's not where you want to attack the problem. Move the bottleneck elsewhere because it's not the port-to-port latency.
But certain industries do care. Financials care a lot about this. High-frequency trading people care a lot about this because high-frequency trading folks are crazy enough to actually measure the length of the cables connecting their host to a switch. So in trading networks where there's expected to be neutrality of the different people that might be participating in that network, everybody gets a cable length that's exactly the same because of the possible nanoseconds worth of difference.
Physics.
Yeah, exactly right. So there are, it is worth mentioning because that's a statistic that's out there and certain architects are going to care about it.
So Ethan, I think a good kind of final question to nail this little piece of our conversation right on the head would be around the design and looking at the number of hosts that I can fit into the network. How do I size one switch designs, multiple switch designs? And also I'm looking for what's telling me when I really need to crank up the architecture for leaf spine. You know, what are those hot button critical points where it's like, oops, I need to make this bigger or perhaps even smaller?
I'll go back to a point I made earlier is that most shops don't need a huge network. They don't need lots and lots and lots of switches because these modern data center switches are so powerful these days. You can push a ton of traffic through them and they probably won't even be working that hard. So where you know you would need to grow is when you start hitting certain scaling limitations of individual elements in your design. For example, certain switches can only handle so many routes or so many MAC addresses, that kind of thing. And those are well-known limitations that are described in the datasheet of the switches. You're probably going to be into hundreds of thousands of virtual machines or tens of thousands of physical hosts to generate the sorts of numbers that would fill up the table on a switch like that. And at that point, you need to begin thinking about how are you going to actually scale this thing out? Physical access is another concern. If you've got that many physical hosts, well, you got to plug them into something. How you're going to do that will dictate your scaling philosophy. Again, most shops, the average listener tuning into DataKnots probably does not have this problem. And those folks that do, you already know how you're solving this problem is going to be my guess.
It was interesting listening to Ethan deep dive for leaf spine, and I'm always looking for the silo busting. This is a silo busting show on DataKnots, and oversubscription felt like the easy button for when it's great to have a conversation. Now, experience has taught me that asking your application owners how many megabits per second is your thing, they're not going to know. That's just a conversation that you could try, but there's going to be frustration and sad panda. But you have to have the conversation somewhere, and I think that talking to folks at kind of the server and virtualization and storage layer is a good place to start. They're going to have a lot more of an idea of what the broad picture looks like. They can say, oh, this is a database application that we're bringing on. Well, our other databases are running about these kind of numbers and can give you a better swag than just looking at, I would think, just kind of the raw traffic at various pieces of the network. Rather than having that sad panda moment later where 3-to-1 wasn't good enough and you have to go back and ask for more money, or your network is hardly being used and everyone's like, why did we buy these crazy $9 million switches? Those kind of conversations could be good silo busting periods.
The takeaway that I got was that you don't really need a lot of actual devices to build this leaf spine design. You can get away with a smaller number, which is nice. But as you scale or need to be aware of scale, you also have to understand the limitations on the switches themselves, like Ethan mentioned about MAC tables. So it's not a magical design. You still have to watch what your boxes are up to.
I want a magical design.
Oh, I also learned that Chris doesn't like Hootie and the Blowfish.
Not at all.
I'm with you there. Hey, before we dive back into our discussion on leaf spine, I want to thank Viptela for being a sponsor today. Viptela's hybrid SD-WAN technology unifies your MPLS, leased line, and internet-based WAN infrastructure. It's packaged with centralized administration, real-time visibility, and policy control for precise and measurable application performance. A Viptela SD-WAN lets you build flexible, multi-segmented topologies. For instance, your branch sites can have guest Wi-Fi, video, and PCI on different segments, and possibly with a different topology for each. So you could have mesh, star, or hub and spoke, depending on the application and its needs. While the term zero touch is getting overused, simplified deployment means one large retailer brought up 20 to 50 sites per night without technicians for a total of 1,400 sites in just a few months. Viptela's already deployed at thousands of sites across more than 15 Fortune 500 companies in retail, healthcare, financials, and more. And while you don't have to replace your WAN routers, You can really cut operating costs by using the integrated routing, segmentation, and security of the VIPPILA appliance to completely replace your existing CPE. And if you live in New York or you're attending the ONUG conference this November 3rd and 4th, we'll be recording a live Packet Pushers podcast. And what could go wrong with live? We'll be talking with actual customers who've deployed VIPPILA. We're working on the exact details for the venue and the signup, so stay tuned. We had a lot of talk about some of the fundamentals of how leaf spine is different from a traditional three-tier architecture. We talked a little bit about scaling and where it can go. Let's get into some more of the real-life impact. So what am I going to benefit from bringing this design into my organization?
Three things I would bring up here. One is you're reducing the chance of a congestion point. So in a traditional architecture, just depending on how your spanning tree converged, and let's assume that you converged it on purpose in a specific way, you've got a lot of blocked links. And so therefore, traffic between tiers is going to be confined to one cable or one ether channeled group of cables. You can end up with congestion points. So with this design, leaf spine, you're scaling out connections between the layers, and therefore you're reducing the amount of congestion points. It's making it less likely you're going to hit one. Another point is one that I raised earlier, just you're equidistant to everything else that's in the data center. And we talked about this a bit earlier. Application talks to a leaf switch, which is forwarded to a spine switch, which forwards to a leaf switch, and then to the destination on the other side, predictably across the whole data center, no matter what. There's not this complex up and down the tree through multiple layers, potentially, just depending on how you had to do your interconnects. You've built something that's very predictable. And that is good for applications who can benefit from a predictable transaction time. It's always nice to know that you can count on your network to behave the same way every time, deliver packets in the same amount of time every time, and leaf spine gets you much closer to that sort of a goal. And I think, finally, the net benefit you get out of those things, reduced congestion points and equidistance, is much more predictable performance overall. You can really count on the data center performing across that network foundation in a predictable way. An app should be running in a predictable way. And you kind of take the network out of the equation for the most part, as far as application performance goes. If an application starts to suck wind, you're probably not looking at the network as the culprit. You're probably looking somewhere else in the stack.
Yeah, especially as the workloads move, right? Most things have been virtualized these days. And so you can't design it for application A is always going to live in cabinet 4. Maybe in cabinet 9 tomorrow and cabinet 30 the next day. If the network sucks in cabinet 9, as soon as that vMotion or migration that is live occurs, all of a sudden it goes back to being your problem, Ethan. It's the network.
Yeah.
Go blame them. And then you get to blame spanning tree.
That's right.
And also when you mentioned the reduction of congestion points, Dune popped in my head. The spice must flow. And so if it worked for a great science fiction movie, it's also got to work for a great network.
The leaf spice design.
To give it credit, though, it was a book before a movie, and the book was better. So for those that got their nerd rage on, don't worry. I've read the book and seen the movie, so we're good. But anyways, I'm also thinking this could be the way that we optimize traffic for that east-west flow that seems to be much more pertinent in the data center today, meaning servers talking to servers, not servers to the outside world.
Of course, I think the big thing, and it goes back to, you know, why did we do this to begin with? Why has leaf spine become prevalent? And it's just, you know, the nature of how data flows around a data center these days. Again, IP storage, database transactions, remote file system access, clustering of systems where you have got cluster members that aren't in the same racks, and they shouldn't be. They're spread out. vMotion, you know, you're draining a particular virtualization cluster, bringing hosts up somewhere else, not necessarily for DR, just because you're doing maintenance. You know, that's a lot of traffic you're pushing over the network. It's east-west. Backup traffic, distributed computing problems where you've got some problem being solved spread out over a lot of different nodes in the cluster. That's not a very common enterprise problem, but that distributed computing is out there. Again, east-west traffic. And all of these sorts of challenges do very well in a leaf spine design.
So if we're talking about real world benefit, and we had mentioned earlier that you don't necessarily need the same amount of equipment in a leaf spine design as you would in the three-tier architecture, is this going to save me money, or are there some kind of gotcha somewhere?
The amount of equipment you need, I'll just put a caveat in here. How much equipment you need is going to be defined by physical ports more than anything else. You've probably got a lot of bandwidth there in these new modern non-blocking data center switches. So I'll put that out as one thing. You know, another thing, cost. how much do you want to spend is kind of what it comes down to. And depending on what you need the silicon and these switches to do, you can go more simple and save a bunch of money. Another element here is if you're just buying Cisco, you are buying some premium priced equipment. If you're buying Juniper, it's the same story. If you look to other parts of the market, like say white box switching, or to some lesser known brands that you can use to build a leaf spine architecture like Mellanox, you can save money. If you look to Arista, you can save money, although, hey, they just went public. So, you know, where's their pricing these days? I've lost track, but they could be beaten up on price pretty well because they wouldn't want to lose a deal to Cisco. Now that they're as big as they are, I'm not sure. A lot of these switches that are out there are built on the same chipsets. And so the performance is identical depending on what the model is. You look and it's like, oh, they're all Broadcom Trident 2 Plus under the hood, or a lot of the newer, very brand new switches are going to be Broadcom Tomahawk based with 25, 50, and 100 gig per second capabilities coming out of these ports. So you can save some money there. Another point to raise, though, is depending on how your physical data center is laid out, you do have a lot of cables going in between leaf and spine, and therefore optics and cabling can eat up a huge amount of the budget here. So it isn't just the switch. You also got to think about the optics and cabling part of this. You'll be surprised at how much money you can spend in a hurry just interconnecting stuff.
Oh yeah, SFP Plus, it's like what, a $5 part that they charge $300 for? I mean, it's like auto dealer companies are jealous of how much margin is on those things. So that's why I like the Twin Axe cables, because it's usually cheaper, but they don't go as far.
So Drew, I'll just leave it at, yeah, it's possible to save money here, but you got to really be careful. And it brings everything together. It brings in how many ports you need. It brings in how far apart physically your leaf and spine tiers are between each other in the physical data center, which will define what sort of cabling you have to use. And then what sorts of connection. Are you using 40 gig in between layers? Are you using 100 gig? What are the cabling requirements for those different sorts of speeds? And all of that will bear in rather heavily on cost. And so you got to price it up by the project. And I don't think throwing out your three tier and dropping in leaf spine is an automatic, I'm going to save. But throwing out your oversubscribed older switches and dropping in non-blocking with some new hosts that don't have so many 1 gig ports and now have 10 gig ports means you might be able to consolidate to a fewer pieces of equipment overall, both on the server side and the network side, and save money that way, possibly.
Not to mention the benefits that you talked about earlier of essentially a predictable network. You know how things are going to operate regardless of where the host might be.
Exactly.
So another real world practical element, and you mentioned this, I'm not just going to rip out the legacy network I've got in place and plop in a fresh leaf spine design. How do I link up leaf spine deployment with a legacy network?
Typically, and this may be counterintuitive, but I mean, if you're a network designer, you go, oh, one of the spine switches connects off. Well, probably not. It's probably actually a leaf switch because, again, it depends a lot on what the design is that you've put in place on top of this physical topology. But usually all the brains and the interesting bits are happening up in a leaf switch. And so usually you're using a leaf switch or a pair of leaf switches to connect off to your legacy network that way. And you're going to do it with whatever your traditional routing protocol was in your data center, BGP or OSPF. You're going to advertise routes from the legacy part of your data center into the new part and vice versa. And you basically got a bridge through a pair of leaf switches over to the legacy network, probably at the core layer on the legacy side. Not the only way to do it, but that is a common way that you would do it.
Feels like a great opportunity to get involved with the design. You mentioned, Ethan, a little earlier, optimizing your server and compute infrastructure. If it's using 1 gig, go to 10 gig or 40 gig, something like that. If you're sitting here kind of like I am, more geared towards the compute side of the house, and you're wondering how to get involved with the network design, this is a great time to bring that request to management or work with the network engineering team to say, I've got these 12 1 gig links on all of my servers. I hate it. Or I'm using this old blade infrastructure where my virtualized or physical pass-through port fabric coming off of my blades is antiquated. Let's take this as an opportunity to start migrating the compute over as well. Use little pizza boxes or new blade architecture that has 10 or 40 gig. Reduce the number of links between the compute infrastructure and the network infrastructure. And make sure that you can plug directly into this new leaf spine network. It doesn't really matter if it's being bolted onto the legacy network, which is probably more prevalent for folks, or if it's a new greenfield opportunity where leaf spine is being deployed as its own piece of the data center or a brand new data center. I think it's just great points to get involved and make sure that the compute side of the house is represented and work with the network engineering team to make the design as awesome as possible.
Okay. Now, I'm aware that 10 gig LOMs are becoming pretty boring and normal. 10G base T is standard nowadays. You can get that pretty easily, as I understand it, on server motherboards. Is 40 gig starting to show up as well?
40 gig only recently became supported. I can't remember if it was ESXi 5.5 or 6.0. I know it's in 6 as a supported interconnect. So you can do 40 gig off a host at this point. Being common? No, not at all. I have yet to see one, just because there's not a lot of use cases where you need that kind of throughput coming off of a host. But it's still something I would like to keep an eyeball on, just because my thought is, as we're getting towards these crazy amount of cores, 20 and 40 cores on a chip, looking at terabytes of memory, having all these fault-tolerant components within a server or compute node, the amount of virtualization we can stack on a node goes up. Maybe we're using a container platform instead of virtual machines, so then I have a bajillion little containers running on this thing. I might want 40 gig for the latency that I get out of it, or just having a big fat pipe to plumb in all these containers to. So I think it'll be coming around the corner not too far from now.
And don't overlook 25 and 50 gig either. You know, those are becoming more and more common as well. I think we're going to see that continue to grow because of certain of the markets in the cloud space that are driving that. Well, all right, everyone, that is it for today's Data Knots podcast. Let's go around the table and plug our Twitter handles, folks. Drew, starting with you.
Drew_CM on Twitter.
I'm at Chris Wall on Twitter. My blog is wallnetwork.com, and I like SpongeBob.
Thanks for that. And I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. EthanCBanks.com is my blog. And of course, this is the Data Knots podcast, which you can find on the Packet Pushers podcast network. PacketPushers.net is home base for us. You can find this and several other Data Knots shows right up there. And until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed.
Ooh, we're running long.
I talk a lot.
We'll cut you. Yeah, we'll cut you a little bit.
I'm going to cut you.
I told you I could get to the point.
Nicely done.
Ethan, you're so great. You're like an A5 steak. I would eat you up.
I'm ready.